Greetings and salutations. My name is Brother Francisco Whitaker. I'm a Benedictine monk and deacon of St. Vincent Arch Abbey in La Trobe, Pennsylvania. I am joined by my older brother, Tom Whitaker, a resident crazy West Virginian. Mm-hmm. Or crazy because he is a resident West Virginian, I suppose. I don't know which one came first. And you are listening and or watching, potentially, the All Good in the Brotherhood podcast. So thanks for joining. Times are a-changing in the monastery. We're back in school again. I can't believe summer's... I mean, summer's not over, like, seasonally, but, like...
Oh, yeah.
When school starts, summer's over. I mean,
but it's, like, it's dark out. It's we've had a week of steady cool. It's we went from, man, this summer is, like, all high 80s to it's been, like, a week of, like, high 60s and like, low 70s. It's, and, there's tons of leaves falling outside our property, so it's looking like autumn for sure.
Which is weird in August, but so yeah, semester's back, and we had our opening mass, you know, for the seminary, because la-di-da, I was one of the deacons, we had two, I was one of the deacons, and I was really struck by something Father Ed, the rector of the seminary, said in his homily. He was talking about, you know, kind of each year, though we return back to the same place and the same people, we almost never return in the same way. Mm. And we never return to do exactly the same thing. Even if I'm coming back to do seminary, I'm not learning the same things. I'm not engaging the material the same way. How I receive and how I give, you know, in thought and reflection have changed because I am changing. And he quoted St. John Henry Newman, who's going to be declared, or who was just declared, and I think it'll be official, the newest doctor of the church.
Yeah.
He said that things must change in order for them to stay the same, and things change in order to remain true. And we grow in holiness only insofar as we are willing to accept the change that God brings in our life. And that was just really helpful for me to hear because honestly, that day, the semester starting, I was not super thrilled about the idea of going back to school for multiple reasons. One, I really do not want to be in school anymore. Like, I was walking to the bookstore today to pick up some books, and I was thinking, like, here we are, 10 years later.
You've done that ten years.
Ten years later of starting as a freshman here, and I'm still going to school like this.
Books.
Why? You know. I'm really happy Nate started law school because he started and finished college and I'm still in school. So glad misery enjoys company. Anyways, so I was just like not super thrilled about the idea of starting school. One, because like, you know, more academics and I'm just a deacon and I just want to be a priest and I just don't want to do work anymore. But more of the big thing was I just recognized that at the end of this year and even into this year, there's just a lot of change coming. Like when I'm ordained a priest, like my life will really not look the same probably ever again. You know, I'll be off in a parish. I'll be doing pastoral ministry. I'll be, you know, doing sacramental things, which are all things I desperately want to do. And I realized kind of the first time though, the implication of the change that that's going to entail, that like a lot of the friendships that I have, not that they're going to be gone, but the way in which they are is going to change the frequency of interaction or my availability. Seeing you guys, you know, I get to see you guys pretty often. Like, my weekends are not going to be the free times I have anymore. Oh, yeah. Those would be my most booked times. And like, some almost like the fear of change was starting to come up. And so Father Ed saying that, I was like, wow, you know, there's another quote. I think this might be G.K. Chesterton. I'm not sure. But there's two things that humans hate, change and that things stay the way that they are. And which is super funny and ironic.
Yeah.
Anyways, I know I'm just like throwing a bunch of things out there, but I think what's I've been struck by is the importance of change in the growth and development of our personhood and our souls. Mm-hmm. Yet it is often something we resist the most because it's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And we have to be willing to die those little deaths.
Yeah.
Like dying a million deaths to live one life. And what do we do when those changes aren't just like kind of casual or normal, like the changing of the seasons, but which really almost we could perceive as a disaster yeah. or as an annihilation of something that we don't want to lose. Hmm. So that's what we're throwing out today. How do we deal with those things? What do we do with those things? I want to approach them that from a monastic perspective, but you would approach it maybe from your married perspective, your time in the workforce, your time in the military, which I'm sure they had to throw. Literally, the whole goal is, what do you do with this new crap we throw at you? So, yeah. What are your thoughts or reactions to start?
I'll try to treat all of those in at least a soundbite for each, because they're all interesting. And like you said, there's like a million deaths in one life, if you will. It sounds very dramatic, but I think it's actually kind of an interesting way to think of that. But before I start that, I just want to like say, I think, and it just hit me, what's one cool thing about this podcast, you know, and I hope people can kind of appreciate this. There may be others out there that would follow this track, but if not, it's kind of a very cool aspect of this, is your story, Deacon and Brother Francisco, is that there's now a group of people that have been able to walk with you from like kind of the beginning through seminary, through all the classes and oh man, another school year and it'll enter into the priesthood. And like, I can't imagine there's, if any, like a podcast or a vlog or anything like that, that has like documented like how that's impacted you. And I think that's very cool. So I hope people can appreciate that they can see the million deaths to self, because you can see it often in, you know, parents and like newlyweds and all those things that occur as you're going through those evolutions. But unless you're family members with a seminarian or someone, like, you're probably not going to fully appreciate what it means for a young man to go through all of that and then come out the end, kind of with all that you'll carry in your rucksack, to take an army ism.
Today is we're celebrating 3 years of the podcast, which is pretty sweet.
Oh, that's cool. That's a cool 3-year anniversary thing. But yeah, so to treat kind of all those, I'll say, you know, for people that fit in the category of college student age, there is 100% like a dying, there's a death that comes at the end of college. And it's that, even if you are kind of like an adult in college and you're making decisions and yada, yada, there's a death that occurs once you start recognizing you got to make your own food, you got to buy your own groceries, you got to pay your own bills, you got to find rent, you got to get yourself to work, you got to get yourself to work on time, you got to get a vehicle. I mean, all these things just start hammering. And, you know, some students, while they're still in undergrad or whatever, they're kind of like allowing aspects of those to leak in. They're you know, they're kind of staying ahead of that power curve. But some, it just hits them full on in the face, and that's a brutal disaster, like you said. It's like, it's not even just like, oh, this is a little different. This is like, oh crap, this is like the end of my life. I will never have fun again. This is why everyone says college is the best time of your life, which it's not. That's also totally bogus.
Well, yeah, that's super bogus, by the super way. Bogus. For all of our college age listeners, it's not. Yeah.
It is not even close to the best time of your life. But it is a time of your life when you have like a weird sense of being responsible with no true actual responsibilities. No offense to students, but it ain't reality. And so you have that death and coming out of college, and that comes with kind of the pain and the loneliness that sometimes come. And again, it can be very quiet. Like a lot of people are like, oh yeah, you graduated, like, you know, however many other million people this last year. Congrats, join the workforce. Okay. Move on. But it can be very painful, and it can be a lot of loneliness and isolation there. And then, yes, you know, with the military, I kind of went through that almost twice, because you go in the military, you're kind of indoctrinated, you sort of develop a brotherhood, you know, in my context with the guys that I had in my unit, the guys that I worked with, the guys that I even eventually got to lead as a team. And then when I made the decision to step away, it's kind of a new death, kind of similar to the ending of college, where you've more than likely bonded with a smaller group of people through shared struggle, shared mission, you know, shared trials and, you know, and all that comes with that. And then you have to kind of say goodbye again. And both of those, and you know, the commonality in those two contexts is that you really are like moving on from an environment that you become comfortable in. You're moving on from somewhere that you sort of felt like this is somewhere where I will kind of always be safe, you know, and then you have to step out into a new territory, a new environment. In marriage and then in parenthood, it's a little different, because it's actually stepping into a community that's going to ask more of you than probably any of your other communities have before. So when you step into marriage, of course, it's a dying to the, well, I can just play pickup frisbee whenever I want, or I can go play on a rugby team, you know, still, or whatever it is, you know, the things that you're like, oh, wow, I'm married now. Mm-hmm. I have to die to myself so that I am not inconveniencing my wife, my husband, etc. And I have to make sure that I am willing to set aside those things that I just have kind of given as like, well, this is a staple to my week. This is a staple to my routine. And, you know, spending 2.5 hours at a climbing gym every day was not going to happen after we got married. You know, that was something I totally did as a single guy living down in Arlington, Virginia. And you just have to recognize that those things are dying, you know, and you have to, it's to your point, it's a part of the refinement of our character, part of the refinement, you know, and again, as you're stepping into vocation specifically, it's a way that we can be tempered in holiness in our walk and state. And certainly the same applies to parenthood. And I think the funnier one, maybe it's not funny, but one of the most relatable ones, because we got, Johanna and I are probably a little bit ahead of the curve of some of our peers. There's other peers that are like, holy shnikes, they really got busy.
They took the be fruitful and multiply very literally.
Yeah, very literally. But we got three kids and we're still like on the younger end by a lot of other people's estimations. So we got friends that are like about to have their first, they've just had their first, and they're like, well, what was the hardest transition? And to me, the hardest transition is 0 to 1. You know, it's always like you went from as a couple when you're married. Yeah, we can go to the trivia nights. We can go out and go bowling. We can go have, you know, go to the bar with our friends. We can have game nights till 2 a.m. and it doesn't matter, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's like, oh, well, now we got to do bedtime. Well, that's new. Yeah. Like, oh, wow. We got bedtime takes a while. Bedtime can take like anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour and a half, depending on how crazy the night is. And, you know, the first, even within that, there's like another mini death. There's that, oh, the baby, the newborn, the 0 to 6 months, you can actually still do some of that stuff. You can carry them in their little car seat and you can take them to a low key enough event and people be like, oh, the baby's so cute. And you're like, yeah, we're still having fun.
We're hip.
Newlyweds, we're cool. We can hang out with the cool kids.
Still hang.
You probably get to around 8 months, I'd say, maybe even before that. And you're like, ooh, we can't do that anymore. This baby cries a lot. Like some people don't actually love like a screaming baby hanging around them all night, and that's okay. Like it's not that, you know. I think it's less okay than
but...
like, you should be a little more okay with it. But that being said, there's time and a place for that, and you have to recognize, oh, we have to give up some of the pickup sports. We have to give up some of the trivia nights. We have to give up some of the hangs with our friends, and we have to be parents and take care of this in a little. And that kind of just compounds with every kid after that. It doesn't really get like, you know, tons worse. It's just sort of, you know, you go from like near total freedom to basically none. And that's a meritorious dying, you know, a meritorious death of, you know, and lots of people experience it, like you said, in different ways. Some are like, yeah, it's okay. I kind of like it. I kind of like staying home. And some people, it's crippling. They're like, I thought I had an identity, and it was kind of hung upon all of these other things that I was doing with other people. I was part of these communities that I felt safe and stable and secure in. And now I have to be okay with this community, which maybe is me and my spouse and a new baby at home, you know? They're challenging, but they're 100% a time and a place where we can grow in holiness and accept the refinement of our soul in our vocation. Those are very interesting thought, though, like all the deaths, you know, the midlife, does a monk have a midlife crisis, you know?
Think I had a quarter life crisis.
There
so.
You go. So, yeah, well, go ahead.
Well, so speaking to that, there's just like a lot of things that you said that I wanted to respond to. I think you also talked about like a space or a community or an identity with people or in a situation or with what you do, right? Whether it's in college, in the military, you know. And I think the why we could be, you know, see some of the change that might happen around us that's either sometimes necessary, sometimes forced upon us, or sometimes it's based on what we choose as well, is... It's a loss of an ideal, or it's a loss of what I know. It's a loss of what I find to be most purposeful, or what I believe people know and love about me, maybe even. I think sometimes the question I've asked myself when something has not gone the way I expected to, and I kind of end up losing maybe a good aspect of, I don't know when I say like identity, but like when I joined the monastery, I did think, now, luckily this God's providence and, you know, you give God a little, he gives you so much more back. I thought I would like kind of lose all ability to like play pickup sports in some aspects, or at least like competitively the way I thought I could do it. Right.
Yeah.
And that was a huge deal for me. Yeah. Like, honestly, sometimes, and this sounds like kind of arrogant, but sometimes that was a bigger thing to let go of than like the idea of like personal, like freedom and autonomy to go do what I want. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, with friends or movies, you know, other things, but like, it was like sports. Because
it is one of your top strengths.
Well, so. There's that, but it's because I chalked up so much of like what I presented to others in athleticism. So if that's changing, what do I have left to present of myself now? Like, am I boring? Because I've worried that I was a boring person. So, well, if I don't have athletics to kind of like make up for like that I'm boring, do people want to spend time with me, right? The loss of an ideal thought or ideal presentation of myself. So now I might have to just actually present who I am. Do I even like that? And if I don't like that, then I'm going to be super uncomfortable, and that's going to cause a crisis. Because how could anyone like what I give if I've lost what means the most to me or what I think makes me the best? And what we really need in those situations is, A, friends who actually just know us, and regardless of anything other than what we think is the best part of ourselves, but is also a relationship with he who is most constant and who doesn't care about any of those things that we present. And we change. God is unchanging. And that is where we need to hold that stability. If all these things are going on around us, it's because I think when things change in our life, it's because God has decided that whatever place we were in, we have learned all we can about loving him and others in that place. So now if something needs to change, it's because we cannot learn anymore there, and we need to move to another place. And if that means the loss of things, it's because maybe those weren't really rooted in authentic love. So I actually, after hearing Father Ed's homily, I was kind of praying on it the next day, in reflecting on the scripture for this upcoming Sunday for a Bible study I was leading. And the scripture passage for this Sunday is very much the theme of humility. And I've heard tons of different definitions of humility, my favorite being C.S. Lewis's. But I kind of created one of my own, which is that humility, like authentic humility, at least a mark of authentic humility, is the ability to accept the love we are given as it is given to us. And I think unless we're willing to change or kind of accept the seeming crisis of the loss of maybe some ideals or expectations on ourselves, we won't be able to accept it. And acceptance of situations, moments as they are, changes that comes, we truly can accept it. What happens when we're in the future and we look back? We're grateful. If we can't stand the change, if we resist it, if we're angry or sad, overly sad, or self-pitying about it, what happens when we look back? We're resentful for what happened, and we're not growing now. And I know I'm like scattering like a ton of different seeds that maybe hopefully are falling somewhere, but just I think the crisis, you know, if you ask, do monks have midlife crises or like a quarter life crisis, would be, I think what, you know, someone who just retires experiences, that's kind of maybe a midlife crisis time. Someone who has to, like, you know, in their 20s or 30s, they start a family or they have to move their job, all these things. The real question is, am I still who I am if I don't have these things? Or who am I? That's usually where crisis comes, like an existential crisis. Who am I? Who am I without? And whatever that blank fill in the blank is. Yeah. Who am I without sports? Well, God was really gracious and he let me play rugby even as a monk. So like that was pretty cool. But that wasn't a guarantee, right? I honestly think I got to a point where I said, all right, I guess I just won't. ever get to have that kind of experience. And then he came back and said, I needed you to accept that you couldn't for you to still have it. Because then it was a gift received rather than a demand fulfilled.
Wow.
Just a bunch of random thoughts.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I think what I focused on in some of my examples is kind of the exiting of, you know, like the exiting of a safe place or an ideal as being the death, rather than recognizing the significance of assuming a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And like that is, and then that's of course the point of change, is that whatever it was is now different. You know, it's going in a different direction, some way, shape, or form. But yeah, like the death is that acceptance of something that is, you know, not consistent with what you've grown comfortable with, what you've built up as that ideal, again, what you tie your identity to. And being able to accept that is I think very significant in your ability to succeed in that next stage of your life. And succeed's a very succeed brings a lot of kind of baggage with it as a term, but
flourish.
Yes. To gain the virtues, you know, because you can step into a new part of your life, and you can choose to despair in it. You can choose to find no hope or no value in what you're doing. You can, you know, become the worker, you know, leaving college, joining a workforce that just sits on your phone all day, because work is boring compared to like going around doing stuff with your friends. Not flourishing, my friend. You know, you can choose a lesser road as you take those new steps, or you can die to yourself to assume, you know, the new responsibilities and kind of the new trappings of that role or environment that you're going to be part of. So what? Go ahead.
I was going to ask you, well, what's a practical? It's like some of these things we're talking about seem kind of theoretical or even just like personal experience, right? And what has been either your way or what are good ways to actually die to yourself? Like, what are practices? Because that's a phrase that's kind of thrown around, you know, among like more pious Catholic people, like death to self or like accepting, like, you know, daily small deaths or whatever, which is great. What do we mean by that? And this is just a mantra I'm on. Just like when people say things, I'm just like, well, what do you mean? Like, you need to tell me, because like otherwise it doesn't actually mean anything. I'm not saying it means nothing when you say it. I'm saying,
No.
For those who listen and watch, like, how can we actually, if we're in a moment of change and crisis, or even if it's just that which we've been doing has become mundane, and that itself, feeling something that used to give us joy no longer giving joy, is a change we have to experience. How do we deal with those things, and what are practical things we can do to let the death of self or the slow death be healthy and not just a loss?
Yeah, two things. One was a learning curve for me, which is kind of you can choose to adopt. And when I say choose to adopt, I mean, you'll have to. So once upon a time, yeah, I'll slow down for a little bit. Once upon a time, I would have thought you can call it positive self-talk, or kind of that active, you know, like stoking an active voice, an active belief, you know, even if it's something that like kind of your emotional predisposition is like, yeah, I'm not feeling this, really not. You can choose to commit to an idea that you believe is important. You know, the idea could be, you know, again, as a new parent, you're like, your emotions may be, I'm tired, I'm frustrated because I don't get to go do what I want. You know, to pile on to, you know, newlywed, you know, after you have children, some of those joys of intimacy that you experienced a little bit more relaxedly, if you will, in that time when you are the newlywed, is kind of like, you got to figure things out. You got to be practical, you know, and when and where and all that stuff. And so there's certain things that you may grow accustomed to that you're like, well, I just, these are creating these sense of emotional turmoil. How do I kind of wrangle that a little bit better? So one would be, you know, again, to jump on like the positive self-talk ideas, choose to commit to the idea that what you're doing is important, regardless of your emotional predispositions to it. because that's part of, you know, they say it takes whatever 21 some days to like break a create a new habit, or it can take longer to break like a bad habit, etc. I don't remember what the
it can a minimum of 30, but actually typically 90 days.
Yeah. There you go. Whatever it is, that they all take a actual commitment that is about here and a little bit less about here. And oh, I'll follow your heart. Yeah. No, you have to decide. And this is where, you know, I know going back 2.5 some years ago, talking with you and Nate about the value of Stoics, from reading the Stoics, not to become like wholesale into Stoicism. You know, I'm not saying everybody should buy every aspect. Obviously we've said that before. It's not unilaterally the, you know, the philosophy of choice, but like choosing to recognize that your emotions don't actually govern reality. Like just because how you feel about something, whether it's the discomfort with the change, even like sometimes the way it may create loneliness, isolation, things that are real, not minimizing, but that they don't define the goodness of that situation. Again, this is still a little bit theoretical, but I think the choice is, the practical choice, is deciding that you're going to stoke an idea in your mind that you believe that something is valuable because it is. Just sort of like you got to brush your teeth. Brushing your teeth is not the most fun thing to do. Like, you know, even if you're like, oh, it's good, I like having clean teeth, yada, yada, yada. It's like, most people are still like, oh, I gotta brush my teeth because it's good for me, you know? And think of, you know, that kind of mental, whether it's you get up in the morning and you pray and you say, okay, like, dear Lord, you know, I want to be a good father today and I want to be a good husband today, even at the cost of my own preferences moment by moment. And I want that to drive me rather than whatever my little emotions are in that moment. And I think just the practical thing is committing, yeah, to not letting your emotions govern or dictate the moral value of committing to that stage of life that you're in. And you know, I'm thinking of one of the most compelling pieces I ever read was C.S. Lewis's, I know I've talked about this to the cast, Learning in Wartime, which I would recommend to anybody, which is an essay that you can read, but is based on, actually I think it was first an essay, then he gave the speech at a church in England right around the time that soldiers were being drafted into the service for World War II. And, you know, in a nutshell, the key phrase is, the present moment is the only moment that any graces can be bestowed or good work done. So the present moment, where you are at, is the only time when you can truly partake in the receiving and re-giving of graces. And, you know, it's not the past. It's not about reliving the glory days. It's not the future about, oh, man, someday I'm going to be there and then it's going to be good. It's about right there, right then. And that's like a mantra, you know, if you will, that I've really tried to let, like, define my sense of peace with the present moment where it's at. And we were talking at the beginning, looks like I've got Lyme's disease right now. Based off, I'm on prescriptions for it, and it's already like making me feel more tired, fatigued. I don't get to exercise and work out already. It's been like a month of just like slow deterioration of my power, speed, endurance. And that does hurt. That does feel like a mini disaster to me. But I can choose to like whine and complain about it, or I can choose to recognize, like you said, that maybe this is a time to recognize that there's a refocusing that God might be calling me to. That isn't, you know, my daily like 45 minutes of exercise as hard as I can, you know, or whatever it looks like. So yeah, that's the practical is to just commit to that idea. You know, again, that the present moment is where you have to live.
I'm all about the present moment these days too, just especially in like, so you kind of projected like how one might cast themselves into the past or the future kind of in a fantasy, positive fantasy. There's also the one to do it negatively, to say like, oh, the past was like so awful and that's the reason why things are the way they are right now. And like, this is like, I'm living like to the detriment caused by the past, or the negative view of the future as that which will come to destroy what I have now. Either doing it kind of in like a fantasy of like glory or a fantasy of despair, both are to escape what we have now. And really literally all we have is today. It's every day, one day at a time, and everything. So if I think that, you know, oh man, if I had just done that in the past, things would be different. Or I just got to do, you know, in the future, like when if something comes up, like I'll react this way. You have no clue. So stop living in the world of what if and live in the world of what is. And that's the present. I know you had something to say, but real quick before I forget, I think a practical thing for me, or that I see as a practical way when we're experiencing some kind of crisis, some kind of loss of what we thought we would be or where we would be, or a change that we knew was coming, it just maybe didn't affect us the way we thought it would, is most of those internal thoughts are probably very self-focused. So what is the best way to get of ourselves is to go out to the other. I think I just have finding service to be the remedy for so many of my problems, but I think particularly when we're experiencing change, it's an okay, healthy reaction to desire to have some control of something, right? But what we should have control of is should also be healthy. So service is a very healthy pastime, doing something for the sake of another. That gets you out of yourself. You're choosing it. So maybe like, okay, this is what I want to do. So we kind of have that again. But it's not just about reasserting my will and my dominance into the moment so I don't lose what I thought I was going to lose or I have what I think I deserve. It's moving out of ourselves. And I would encourage that whatever that service is, it's something that's slightly out of your comfort zone. It's a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
To practice and to get used to being uncomfortable,
yeah. So
that when change comes that is uncomfortable, it's not coming from left field and we're never able to deal with it. But rather like, okay, you know, yeah, this might suck at the moment. I can handle this because I have done that before. And I've seen the good and the growth that can come in being uncomfortable for the sake of another. Maybe I don't see the other in this equation right now, but our actions are always affecting the body of Christ. So how you accept what happens is going to have ripple effects in the spiritual growth or detriment of your brothers and sisters in Christ. So service, particularly uncomfortable service. So for me, that was going to a hospital. I hated it when we were a kid. Mom would drag us to nursing homes and hospitals and stuff to like visit the sick and infirm from our parish community, which is a really good thing. That's a corporal work of mercy. Dragging an 8-year-old, I do not know if that was always the greatest idea. So when I had to go to the hospital for seminary ministry, I was so uncomfortable. I was so afraid. I did not want to do it. But I decided instead of resisting and complaining and moaning about it, just like, all right, well, I have to be here anyways. I might as well do good. And by the end, I actually loved it. And I'd be open to being a hospital chaplain. Like, there's a complete change. So yeah, like that's the kind of thing. Then I completely forgot about how, oh, this is a loss of like, you know, a consistency in the kind of ministry I'm good at. I'm not good at this ministry. It's like, oh, well, God actually can work with us if we just let him change us instead of telling him, well, I'm unchangeable there, so don't bother.
Yeah. I think my two kind of closing points were just one to kind of like affirm and draw the parallel to that active decision to serve in ways that are uncomfortable is very soldierly. Like when you're going through training, boot camp, everything that they're trying to do to you is get you out of your comfort zone and put you in positions and decisions where you have to make a choice that is to your detriment, to the benefit of the greater good, your team, your unit, whatever. You know, it's all about developing somebody who has the ability to respond effectively to that change, that constant ebb and flow of the battlefield, you know, that change that never ceases in those environments. So to your point, being comfortable, almost training your body, you know, your mind, your spirit, your intellect for those changes in real life by, yes, pursuing the services that feel uncomfortable or outside of your, you know, outside of normally what you do on your day off kind of thing, are great ways to sort of build up that resiliency towards the heavier changes that come your way. So I just kind of affirm that. And then one quote that came back, and I'm forgetting the saint, I don't know if it's Saint Therese or even Mother Teresa, but, you know, basically today is all we have, so let us begin. If you remember that one, and the saint or whatever.
So let us be what?
I think it's just so let us begin. Today is all we have, so let us begin. And I might be slightly paraphrasing, so saints or whoever, if I'm forgetting to paraphrase and forgive. But the idea is there. It's like if we only have today, and that's kind of one of those active steps, is just then begin today. Like, don't walk into it in despair with your head navel-gazing, being like, oh, woe is me, the past was great, the past sucked, the future's going to be better, the future's going to suck. You know, today is the only day you have, you know. And again, it seems kind of like a stereotype to, like, live every day, every minute like your last, but it's one of the hardest things to actually do, you know. Like, and it's more so than just a, you know, a catchy idea that sounds kind of nice on a birthday card or something.
Right.
It's really something that you have to try to stoke. But yeah, and I think.
Good. You finish.
No, I was going to say, I think kind of those are my final thoughts, Deacon.
So. Yeah, and I would just close with something I had said, and it should always be both our go-to and our constant is prayer and a connection with God, because if He is the constant, right? Right, St. Paul says, Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. The world, however, is not.
Yeah.
So we must also, as things change, we cannot, right? Jesus says the parable of the man who builds the house on the sand versus the rock. The environment around both is the same that's changing. Yeah. It's what one is rooted on. So while we might have to undergo change and experience these things and uncomfort and crisis and whatever, there has to still be one thing that is unchanging, and that should be our relationship with God. Actually, not should be, it must be. As St. Teresa of Avila said, prayer is not a means to a relationship with God, it is the means. So if you want to have one thing stable, I can guarantee you one thing that will be, the only thing that can for certainly be stable is Christ. And Benedict even talks about that, and he says, like, you know, though, like, all of these things in the monastic life might still affect you from the world, even as you join the monastery, there's one thing that will never change, and that is that you can cling to the rock that is Christ. So, cool. Well, for those who didn't hear, the bell went off for prayer, and that is one constant I do want to keep. Thank you for joining us for another episode of All Good in the Brotherhood podcast. If you enjoyed it, you know, smash the like button, subscribe, send this off to a friend, do those things. If you want to see Nate back again, like, drop a comment, like, where are you? We want you back. And it's not his fault, right? He's not abandoned us. He's got a lot of life changes going on.
Law school is not that hard.
Yeah, law school. I've been in school for 10 years. Like, what's 3 years in law school, you know?
It's only three letters, like L-A-W. That seems pretty
Yeah, exactly. Good. Seminary's like six at least. So, anyways, thank you, Tom. Glad you could be with us. Thank you all for joining, and I hope you all have a wonderful, God-blessed rest of your day.
Yeah. Thanks, all. See you soon.
Peace.